It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Way back before Facebook and Twitter, smartphones, iPods, iPads, even before the internet, NASA, the space agency, released a piece of technology that's still ticking and still performing amazing feats far out in space. In 1977, NASA launched its twin Voyager spacecrafts for what one writer called the longest road trip in the history of mankind. They were dubbed Voyager 1 and 2 and were sent to take a tour of interstellar space, in other words, the space between the stars. Now, 35 years later, Voyager 1 is almost there at the outer edge of our solar system. And earlier this month, it reported some startling data about an area scientists didn't even know existed. They're calling it the Magnetic Highway. It's the farthest places that our sun's particles can reach and where they meet with particles from other stars, defining the outermost bounds of our solar system. The information comes just in time, too. The Voyager spacecrafts are destined to run out of power by 2020 and 2025, so need to get their last reports in before they go dark. The Voyager 1 surprise is just the latest from what's been an amazing few weeks for space science, from the discovery of ice on Mercury to some tantalizing organic matter found on Mars. Today in The Exchange, our sky guys are here with an astronomy update on these stories and much more. And you can call in with your questions, too, whether about what the Voyager probes are showing us or some of these latest headlines from our neighbors, Mars and Mercury. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. And our sky guys are Mal Cameron, former astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center. And Mal, it's good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here, Laura. Thanks.
Also with us, John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. His website is theskyguy.org. And John, always good to see you. Thank you for being here, too.
Great to be here, Laura.
Well, and gentlemen, let's go back to the 1970s, if we could. Pretty exciting about Voyager 1 launched 35 years ago, John. What were these twins supposed to do when they were launched way back when? What was the great hope for them?
Well, their primary mission was to explore the gas giants of our solar system, the outer planets. Voyager 2 actually was launched before Voyager 1 in August of 1977, and 16 days later, Voyager 1 was launched.
But Voyager 1 was faster than its twin sister or twin brother.
Yeah, that was determined by the trajectory the two spacecraft took through the solar system. And due to the alignment of the planets, can't believe I'm saying that, when the spacecraft were launched, it set up a rather unique opportunity for the spacecraft to visit four planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, which Voyager 2 did. Voyager 2 visited Jupiter in 79, Saturn in 80, Uranus in 1986, and its last planetary encounter was Neptune in August of 1989.
And let me just jump in here, John. When you say visit, obviously you don't mean landing, because these are gas giants and there's all sorts of other, I mean, you just can't land on it.
No, that's a very good point.
Right. But so what do they do? Do they sort of get caught up in the orbit of these planets for a time and then snap a lot of pictures or take a lot of data and then move on?
They snapped a lot of pictures, a lot of really good pictures, made a lot of discoveries, collected a lot of data, but did not enter into orbit about any of the planets.
They
just flew by pretty quickly, in and out, takes as much data as you can. And on the gravity of the planet that they were encountering, say Jupiter, bent the trajectory of the spacecraft without using any fuel so that it would encounter the next planet outward from the sun. So Voyager 2 and Voyager 1 used the gravitational assist from Jupiter to target both of those spacecraft for a later encounter with Saturn. And then due to the trajectory that the scientists selected for Voyager 1 through the Saturn system, it precluded it visiting the outer planets as well. So only Voyager 2 visited all four of the gas giant planets.
And so now, Mel Cameron, Voyager 1 is on its way, as I said, at the very outer reaches of the solar system. And the spacecraft sent back some surprising data. Scientists kind of went, wow, we didn't expect to get that. What did they learn from Voyager 1, which is way, way, way out there now?
It right now is about 120 times further away from the sun than the Earth is. And that distance in astronomical terms, we call that one astronomical unit, is the 93 million mile distance from the Earth to the sun. So it's now about 120 AUs, as we say out there. And what they expected to see is, because the sun, like any star, is sending what we call the solar wind. It's basically all these particles of energy going out into space. But at some point, that energy is going to meet or crash into, in a sense, the energy coming from other stars, the interstellar space stuff.
So other solar systems.
Well, many of them are solar systems in that sense, yes. We're finding other planets around stars. But it's basically the star's energy. We live inside the energy of the sun, the atmosphere of the sun, kind of like a big bubble. And think of the edge of that bubble as being the edge that Voyager is currently trying to go through. Scientists expected there would be, we know there's a kind of a shock area that they go through where there was suddenly, I think they expected to go through like a little curtain. And then suddenly they would detect particles coming from outer space and not from our sun. And that would indicate we've now passed through the edge of that bubble. But instead, what they came up with was a surprise. It was this what they're calling the magnetic highway. The magnetometer that's on it's a big long boom-like thing that sticks out on the edge of the Voyager. At the end of that is this magnetometer, which detects these particles, these ions that are coming in and out from different places. And the ions from the sun, if you think of the sun standing straight up and down, the energy it's detecting are coming like in a north-south type direction, or east-west direction, I guess. And then what's happening is, on the other side of that, they would expect that there would be like a north-south direction of interstellar particles. But what, instead of going directly from the east-west to the north-south, they're detecting this other zooming highway. It's kind of like coming to the edge of Route 93, and you want to cross Route 93, the median strip and everything else. I don't know if there's a median strip on this, but there's particles zooming in both directions. It's kind of like we're holding hands with the inside energy from the sun and the outside energy from interstellar space, and allowing these particles to pass back and forth like traffic.
You know what amazes me about this Voyager? I mean, one, that it was way back in 1977. It's amazing that it's still going. It's amazing that it's so far. And Mal, it's amazing to me that it can transmit data to us here on Earth from so, so far out, our brains can't even comprehend how far out it is.
Well, think about, too, as that data travels from there. Right now, a one-way signal from Voyager takes 17 hours to travel at light speed from its distance. Tells you how far away it is.
Not bad, though, really, considering how far it is.
Oh, it's less than a day. But 17 hours. But by the time it gets here, that signal spreads out a little bit. So you're only getting a piece of that. It's literally a whisper from space. NASA has their deep space networks, these huge antennae that are located in three locations around the globe, so that as the Earth spins, we can always pick up these signals. And all of the space probes have different markers to say what frequency they're on, tells you what spacecraft you're listening to. But by the time that signal reaches that, you're getting an amount of energy that's equal to less than a billionth of a billionth of 1 watt of power.
Wow. Well, John, we always talk about this, and you know what I'm going to ask you. So this is really interesting. It's kind of cool to hear what Mal's talking about, these space particles coming out in surprising ways that we didn't expect. But again, beyond that, it's interesting for people who are interested, like the two of you. Why does it matter that we know what's out there now, or that we have a better idea of what's at the far reaches of this sun bubble that Mal described?
Well, scientists want to learn about our neighborhood. the best way to make good practical use of what we learn about space is to understand how where we live in the universe operates and functions, what the risks may be, what the neat things out there to enhance our lives with, and knowing where the solar system sits, knowing how the sun's outflowing solar wind interacts with the interstellar wind that's out there is very important. Incoming cosmic rays, high-energy gamma rays, coming in to our solar system from beyond has, in fact, for billions of years, affected the evolution of life on Earth. So it's important to know about these junctions, these barriers, these interfaces between various media that are out in the universe.
So, and as I said, Voyagers, both of them, are scheduled to expire 2020 and 2025. So what needs to happen before then, John? It's almost like they have to turn in their term papers before they go dark for good.
Well, they're still producing quite a bit of electrical power, and they use plutonium. And as that plutonium decays, it generates heat, and the spacecraft has the means to convert heat into electricity. And that's what powers the radio systems and computers and the instruments that are still operating. Many of the instruments have been turned off. The television cameras are turned off because there's really nothing to see. It's pretty dark out there. So they conserve power by doing that. But the magnetometers and other radio equipment that detects these charged particles, it is its primary mission right now. So they have a number of years. I mean, it's only, you know, just about 2013. So they really want to find, they want to be, to find this boundary that they do detect particles from interstellar space, and this switching from the east-west orientation of the solar wind to the north-south of the interstellar wind is clearly defined by both spacecraft, because both spacecraft are headed in different directions. Voyager 1 is headed up and out of the solar system, and Voyager 2 is heading in another direction. So it kind of gives us two data points as to the way this heliosheath or this magnetic field or this solar wind window bubble around the sun is shaped.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break, including the discovery of ice on Mercury. So stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning, and more of our astronomy update coming up on The Exchange and the 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the mortgage interest deduction, and the U.S. housing market. Stay with NHPR this holiday season. We've scheduled a number of special programs telling stories that remind us all what the season is about. And, of course, we'll bring you lots of music to bring you some of that holiday cheer. Have a look at our full holiday schedule at NHPR.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from EnviroVantage of Epping, a full-service resource for the removal of asbestos, lead paint and mold, and demolition, disaster recovery, and more. Information at EnviroVantage.com. From Hearing Solutions New England, where audiologists diagnose hearing loss and dispense hearing aids in Nashua, Manchester, Concord, and online at HearingSolutionsNE.com. A New Hampshire Business Review and the Bob Awards, featuring 80 business-to-business categories voted on by the readers of New Hampshire Business Review. Details at NHPR.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, an update on the news from outer space. There's been a lot going on, as we've been hearing. We talked earlier about the Voyager spacecrafts that have been exploring the outer reaches of our solar system. Now we turn our attention closer to home with the discovery of ice on Mercury and some more tantalizing announcements from Curiosity roving about Mars. Our sky guys are with us for the hour. They are Mal Cameron, former astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center, and John Gene Forty, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England. The phone number for you to join us, by the way, is 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call with your questions about some of these news items that you may have caught and you want to know a little bit more. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, I have to say, I was surprised by the announcement of ice being found on Mercury. Mal Cameron, it's pretty hot on Mercury. How do they have ice there?
Well, actually, the average surface temperature facing the sun is around 800 degrees. So that's plus. So you wonder, how is this possible?
Right.
Well, the way it's possible is because the way Mercury orbits around the sun. And that means that it's just got the slightest little tilt to it. You know, the Earth has this 23.5-degree tilt, which gives us the seasons, so that in the summertime, the North Pole is bathed in sunlight and the South Pole is dark and reverses this time of year in the winter. On Mercury, there's hardly any tilt at all. So it essentially orbits straight up and down around the sun. So that means that the poles are in total darkness all the time, especially in the deep craters that are on the poles. So if you get down in those craters and the sun's not hitting in there,
and it never hits.
It never hits. It can get very cold because there's no atmosphere to speak of on Mercury. And so there's no atmosphere, no air to heat up and melt even as an effect of a warm atmosphere. So it's basically not almost like our moon. Actually, it's bigger than our moon, but the same idea as on the moon. So on the northern poles that are in total darkness, that's where they found this ice, or evidence for ice. I mean, sometimes we know that we have been able to bounce in the past radar images from Earth, like from Arecibo, the big dish down in Puerto Rico. They've been able to bounce radar waves or radar images off of Mercury from this distance and actually get images of reflectivity in the poles.
So that's how they make these discoveries. Again,
but
there's
but
no
actually,
craft
this discovery
there.
Came from a spacecraft that's orbiting around Mercury right now. It's called MESSENGER, is the acronym for it. And I don't know what all the words mean, but they always make these things that come out. These MESSENGER, meaning like Mercury was the Roman messenger, you know, and so on. And I guess you can send flowers that way, too, or something. But in any event, this spacecraft has been orbiting now for over a year, and it has looked at the poles and found evidence. It has detected hydrogen that it needs for this, and the amount of hydrogen is such that it indicates that there's a lot of ice there.
Well, and John, is this ice as we know it, good old frozen H2O, or is it a different sort of weird Mercury-esque ice?
Well, the radar signals and the messenger data tell us that there's lots of pure water ice.
Really?
But they also discovered some organics mixed in as well, which gives us a key to where the water came from. It's doubtful that that the water that they're finding on Mercury is left over from the formation of Mercury. The inner solar system, when the inner planets, the terrestrial or Earth-like planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars formed, it was pretty warm in the interior of the solar system, too warm for water to exist. You find a lot of water in the outer part of the solar system, but we don't think much survived the formation when the sun first turned on. It was pretty hot. So where the water came from on Mercury was a question, an interesting question, and that's thought to have originated mostly by infalling objects.
Like, so it's not homegrown. It from a passing comet, it dropped off.
There may be some very small residual amounts of water that was outgassed from the planet when it was cooling, but that probably is long since gone. But what's happened on Mercury is that, in fact, almost the entire solar system has been bombarded by infalling objects since it formed some 4.65 billion years ago. All you have to do is look at the moon or look at Mercury through these images from spacecraft, and it's just littered with craters.
Well, yeah, and that raises something that one scientist said, and I wanted to ask you, John, since we're talking about water. He said, the more we learn about our solar system, the more we discover it's a soggy place. Now, what do you think of that, John? I mean, soggy, that may be stretching it a little bit, but I think the point he's trying to make is we're finding water in more and more places around the solar system, right?
That's exactly his point. We used to think many, many years ago that water was a rare, precious commodity, which it certainly is because we need it to survive. But it's very, very plentiful in our solar system. A lot of the moons of the outer planets have water. Mars has lots of water still. It's all frozen. It's not liquid as far as we know. We haven't found any liquid water on Mars. And certainly the water on Mercury is in the frozen state. I'll point out, though, that in October of 2009, the LCROSS mission, NASA LCROSS mission to the moon, and as well as an Indian spacecraft that visited the moon as well, detected the same kind of water deposits in the north and south polar regions of the moon. Deep inside craters where there isn't any sunshine, water had accumulated there as well.
And we didn't know that before.
And we didn't know that. It was early data in the late 1990s pointed or hinted toward water in the deep down craters in the moon. Now, with its discovery and confirmation of it on Mercury, as well as the moon, he's right. We found a lot more water than we thought in places we didn't think we'd find it.
Since you mentioned the moon, I have another question for both of you. Opens up a whole nother can of worms, but let me also invite our listeners to join us. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, it's an astronomy update. We're sitting down with our sky guys, catching up on all the astronomical news. And you can call in with your questions, whether about what the Voyager probes are showing us from the outer reaches of our solar system, or some of the headlines we're looking at now, the discovery of ice, for example, on Mercury, and the idea that our solar system may be a wetter place than we thought. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the exchange page at nhpr.org. And here's an email, gentlemen, from Ben. This relates back to our earlier conversation about Voyager. Ben says, will we be sending out a third Voyager to do further testing of interstellar space? And can we use modern and more advanced technology to collect even more data than the current Voyagers are capable of? Ben, it's a great question, and one I had as well, Mal. I mean, these Voyagers are very impressive, but surely the technology has improved over the last 35 years.
Well, that's true, but we still use, when we go that far out, just remember, if we wanted to investigate up close, as Voyager is doing right now, the big thing is speed. How do we get things here? Voyager 1 right now is traveling at about 38,000 miles an hour, and it's taken this long to get to where it is now, from 1977 to now. How long do you want to wait to do things? We are studying that region of space, though, Ben, by another spacecraft that actually had a lot of its production was done here, and its conception was here right at the University of New Hampshire.
Really? Wow.
It's called IBEX. And it's looking at other particles from and reading what they're made of and what that little wall at the edge of our bubble is all about. And that's been up there for a little bit already. But that's in orbit around our whole area. It stays close by, and it just collects particles from out there. But to actually get out there again, right now I know of nothing on the books to plan to send another Voyager out there. But it's basically the time it takes to get there that's the problem.
There's no express train.
No express train.
Well, Ben, thanks a lot for the email. Good question. And you can email us your questions as well at exchange@nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. So, John, you mentioned the moon. And here's my big question for both of you. And I want to spend a couple minutes looking at this. Today's a date of note in space history. 40 years ago, on December 11th, 1972, we keep going back to the 70s this hour, the last Apollo mission to the moon blasted off from Cape Canaveral, Florida, marking really the end of an era, John. I mean, what comes to mind for you from this, first of all?
Well, for me, the most important part, other than that being a sad day, because a couple of lunar missions were canceled after the Apollo 17 mission, there were originally a couple of more missions planned and scheduled, but the Apollo program was terminated after that. But the Apollo 17 mission carried the first and only scientist to the moon.
A geologist.
A professional geologist
to look at moon rocks.
Yes. Schmidt was his name.
Harrison Schmidt.
And he did a lot of good work, good geological work, but he was the first scientist, and it was the last mission. So that stands out in my memory as being somewhat strange as I, you know, learned about astronomy as a child. It seemed to me strange that only one scientist ever made it to the surface of the moon.
Did he actually go down and walk around?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. So I'm hearing maybe some regret, John, that more scientists weren't allowed to go up. I mean, with all due respect to astronauts, scientists who could study the rock and study other aspects of the moon that maybe an astronaut might not appreciate.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can't match a person whose career was geology in terms of analyzing rocks.
Right.
Clearly, the Apollo program was certainly probably more about politics and national pride than it was about science. But it was an important step in the American space program.
Well, and given this date, then, here's the big question. There was a report recently from none other than the National Academy of Sciences that really painted, gentlemen, a dim picture of NASA. They released a report in early December saying that NASA itself seemed lost in space, not their words exactly, but almost. The panel said NASA didn't have a clear sense of where it's going, what it's doing. What do you think, guys? Mal, you first. Fair critique or not?
Well, I'd read that article briefly, and I guess I can kind of agree. It seems like NASA, what they're saying is that NASA is waiting for a direction, and they've been getting mixed signals from where we should go. President Obama has changed things around and said, gee, we should go to an asteroid, something exciting. And I think, in all fairness to NASA, NASA does a lot of work for us. But I think that what the public is looking for, and perhaps what that article is alluding to, we want people in space. We want to get
that's
people
out. That's what's exciting.
Out. Right.
And
that,
the
that's what gets
over.
Up the excitement. And it's a vicious circle, because if you can get the public excited about what you're doing in space, then you'll get more funding. And so we need to get something to excite people so that NASA can come. And look at all the trickle-down technology that comes from the space program, that came from the space program. Going to the moon gave us new technologies. We had to learn over the years of we've got new ways to insulate things, insulation things. We've got things that have helped medicine.
Tang.
And well, we've always had Tang. I don't know if you even have much of that anymore.
It's true.
They actually eat really well on the space station.
Yeah, they have freeze-dried foods
right.
And so forth.
But I think that the idea is they want to see us go out to some grand thing. And one of the things is going to the moon. And I think what they're saying is that we should go back to the moon. There's a lot we're missed there. It's close to home. We are saying that in the 2030s, eventually we'll send people to Mars, but we have a lot to learn about going there. It's a very difficult and death-defying feat, if you will, to go to Mars, because one of the things about going to Mars is that when you stand on Mars, you can only see our own planet, your home planet, for a part of the time you're there. It's going to overtake you and pass you by in the sky because we're closer to the sun. So it goes around faster.
Yeah.
Well, communication is not it, but what does that do for a human being who grew up on Earth and cannot see your home planet?
Well, and to say nothing of the trip there, never mind once you get there.
Exactly.
But, John, there's all sorts of perils, space radiation and the effects of a 9-month voyage and so forth. And if something goes wrong, you know, ooh, you're in trouble. You can't just, you know, it's not just a 3-day trip like it was to the moon.
No, it's riddled with risks, but certainly the benefits are there. Let me get back to your question about NASA losing its way.
Yeah, fair critique or not? What do you think?
Well, I think I agree with Mal, although I find it hard to do that. But
thanks, John.
I think NASA needs some direction. It needs more direction and a sustained direction that's independent of the administration in command. It needs a long-term goal, a set of long-term goals, not just manned space science, but unmanned space science.
Which they're doing.
Which
they're
doing.
They've got probes and rovers.
But
and so
it's
forth.
Been recently cut back significantly. Unmanned robotic spacecraft help us learn about the solar system. It helps us learn that there's lots of water out there. It helps us learn that there are at least 7 or 8 places in the solar system that could and could have presented a habitat for life in some time in the past of the solar system, the history of the solar system. So NASA is the same organization that constructed, launched the Voyager spacecraft, that are still running 35 years later, 11.3 and 9.2 billion miles from Earth, still producing electricity, and we still know where they are. within a few miles despite this great distance.
That is pretty impressive.
We have five spacecraft operating at Mars right now, two on the surface, three orbiting the planet. We have one spacecraft orbiting Mercury, and we have one on its way to Pluto that'll get there in July of 2015. That's one heck of an organization that knows how to do things.
Well, both of you have mentioned that it isn't just a scientific proposal. It's a political proposal, a funding proposal about where this agency goes. And, you know, John Mao mentioned that the one place the White House wants to send astronauts, you know, actual boots on the ground, so to speak, is a nearby asteroid. But I've read that people inside NASA are not very excited about that.
Well, they're not excited about a directorate without any funding. It's like an unfunded mandate by the government. You have to do this, but we're not going to give you any money. How excited can you get about that? Not very. Asteroid probably a good target to send people. You could learn a lot about asteroids. After all, we don't know how many asteroids there are that could be potentially hazardous, which means could get close to Earth and hit us. We're always subject to that. I'm not saying there's an asteroid with our name on it, but it pays to understand the inner solar system and small orbiting bodies because they're a potential hazard. So studying an asteroid and landing on it would help you gain the technology to perhaps alter the trajectory of an asteroid that we find in 20 or 30 years might be on a course to Earth. So, and in 50 years, I believe, we'll be mining asteroids for materials that are in short supply on Earth. So there's probably some good reasons to visit an asteroid, but please fund the mission if that's the directorate you're going to give NASA.
Well, and this is a time, though, Mal, where,
exactly,
you know, people feel like there's not much money for, you know, Social Security, Medicare, tax relief, whatever, never mind, you know, funky missions to asteroids that just don't seem, you know, very compelling at this point in time. I mean, there's a budget crisis on.
I don't know. From a personal point of view, I don't get excited about asteroids. I mean, I understand John's point of view that yes, it's important to know how to get to it. I can see the picture if we find an asteroid that we know is heading our way. It might be fortuitous to know how to get there with people to plant something on it to redirect it or whatever. I'm more excited about getting to Mars, a place like that, where you can spend some time and learn more about it personally.
All right. Well, after a short break, we'll hear what our listeners think. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Keep it right here.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling. For any plumbing, heating, cooling, or drain problem, offering annual tune-ups in efficient heating systems, online at justcallheritage.com. And the Wealth Management Group at Merrimack County Savings Bank, trust and wealth management services provided by advisors committed to your financial needs, themerrimack.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
Today on Word of Mouth, Machine Gun Safari. A gunslinging greenhorn explores the allure of assault weaponry. And Laughter on Demand. A slew of female comedians are launching comedy careers through podcasts. I'm Virginia Prescott with the new digital stand-up circuit on Word of Mouth. Today at noon and again at 9 on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with our Sky Guys about recent missions and new discoveries in the world of astronomy. We've talked about the Voyager missions exploring the very outer reaches of our solar system. Also about the discovery of ice on Mercury, some tantalizing organic matter found on Mars. We've been looking at these and other headlines, including a recent very critical report from the National Academy of Sciences about the direction of NASA, saying basically the space agency was itself lost in space. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And guys, before the break, we were talking about how the public likes to see people in space, whether on an asteroid, as John wants, or on Mars, as Mal wants. And Mal, an American astronaut will do something new in space. He'll go to the space station in 2015, try to break the record of how long an American has lived in space. Who is he and why is he doing this?
Good question. He's a pretty crazy guy. No, actually, he's a well-known. In fact, I was looking back at this back in 2007, when I was still employed with the Discovery Center, I had the great opportunity to watch a space launch of the shuttle. And it was with Barbara Morrigan aboard, who was Krista McAuliffe's backup.
I remember that.
At the time.
Yeah.
And it was just so exciting to see that. But the commander of that mission is Scott Kelly. He has a brother named Mark Kelly, who is the husband of Gabby Giffords, you remember. And Scott and Mark are twins.
Oh, wow.
But
Gabby Giffords, by the way, being the Arizona congresswoman who was shot very badly a couple of years back. And, yeah.
Right. A lot of people know him and they've seen his picture.
Sure.
But if they saw a picture of Scott, his brother, you would see the same thing because they're identical twins. But they both flew. But Scott was also the commander of this mission in 07. But he has been pegged to go on this year-long mission to spend one complete year on board the space station, along with a Russian cosmonaut. His name is Mikhail Kornienko, who also has a lot of space time in his background. They are going to start training next year. And in the spring of 2015, they will board the space station and not come back until the spring of 2016.
And I'm sorry, but it sounds kind of boring after a while. I mean, don't you go crazy? I can't imagine the space station is that big.
This is
a little claustrophobic up there.
Well, not really. This is it's the world's biggest camper in space, I guess. Except it's always dangerous outside, so you have to stay inside unless you put your spacesuit on. But consider now the average staying time for a person on the space station is generally 6 months. So they're simply going to double that. The idea is goes along with what we talked about previously. If we're going to go to Mars, we are going to spend a long time in space. And one of the steps that we need to learn in order to be able to do that and feel comfortable about sending people there is to know what are the effects of long-term space travel, and in space, specifically the zero-gravity-ish type thing. Microgravity, they're floating around and all the effects that has on the body. They know that your bones deteriorate, your muscle mass deteriorates. In going to Mars, you got to worry about other things like cosmic rays from the sun, too. But what are the long-term effects of spending that long time in space? After 6 months, when people come back to Earth, they generally now land in Russia on a Russian Soyuz spacecraft, and they don't open the door and they just pop out and start walking around. They literally carry them out of their capsules, put them on little couches, and
because their muscles are so deteriorated?
All of a sudden, they're not used to gravity anymore. You
Wow.
feel like you weigh a ton and a half. But imagine after 1 year, there'll be a lot of medical tests done on them before, during, and after the flight. They're willing to be the guinea pigs to say, okay, after a full year in space, how long is it, what's this going to be like to our bodies?
Well, and John, I'm guessing that if chosen, you would totally volunteer to be the guinea pig up there.
My vote, John.
There was a Russian guy a couple years ago who did this, who spent a year in space, and he was kind of jelly when he got back, wasn't he, John?
Yeah, he was. He was not in that good a shape, as you can expect. I mean, if you're a workout aficionado and you go to the gym a few times a week and you feel you're in pretty good shape and you don't go for a year, think about what kind of shape you'd be in at the end of a year. In the case of an astronaut being in the space station under very low gravity conditions for a year, your muscles, your skeletal system has no resistance, very little resistance, and your muscles will weaken for out of disuse. I mean, yes, they have a crude treadmill and exercise capability there, but nothing near your gravity of your home planet. So over the course of 365 days, That's a lot of wear and tear that your body didn't get. So it's going to have to take some time to get used to things again.
Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page or on the Exchange page at nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And real quickly, so these guys, the American, Mr. Kelly, John, and the Russian will be going up to the International Space Station. It was just announced yesterday, John, that NASA's given out about $30 billion to three private companies at about $10 billion apiece to develop some kind of craft to replace the shuttle, transport Americans up to the International Space Station. So this is part of this privatization trend, right, John, that we're seeing at NASA?
Yes, and part of that money will be spent with these companies so that these companies can certify spacecraft as being safe and spaceworthy. So there are a lot of commercial ventures now exploring the possibility and even planning for suborbital flights, where it means you just go up and come down, low Earth orbit flights. And also, I recently read that just a couple of days ago that a company called Golden Spike is a company composed of politicians, former NASA executives that want to send people to the moon for a fee of about $1.4 billion by 2020.
Well, so a private company going to the moon.
A private company. So they're going to target not only rich folks, but also they estimate that there's between 20 and 30 countries that would take them up to get them to the moon as well.
So it's the perfect birthday present for the guy or gal who has everything.
That's right.
Let's go to the phones. And Dustin is calling in from Lebanon. Hi, Dustin. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. How are you doing today?
Good.
I had a question about, you know, this rumor going around about the Mayan calendar and everything. And supposedly we're supposed to be passing through the galactic equator, or the dark rift, as it also heard it called. I'm just wondering if you could talk briefly about that. Is there any actual fact behind that? Is that something that really occurs? And if so, if it is going to happen, what do you think we could expect here?
Yeah, Dustin, it's a great question, and one I had in my plan to ask you, John. There has been a lot of talk about the so-called end of the Earth on the 21st of December based on the Mayan calendar and all sorts of funky things happening in space, planets aligning themselves in weird ways. Any truth? Thanks for the question, Dustin.
Yes, thank you very much for the question. We get a lot of these kind of questions, and there is an important event that will take place on the 21st of this month, but it happens every December 21st. It's called the winter solstice in the Northern Hemisphere. And that's when the sun kind of reaches its lowest altitude. It's the first day of winter here in the Northern Hemisphere. That is the only significant event that is going to take place from an astronomical perspective on the 21st of December.
That's it.
That is it. Every year, the sun passes by the galactic center, which happens to be beyond the constellation called Sagittarius, the mythological archer. If you're a stargazer, you probably know Sagittarius, as it's known as an asterism called the teapot. Well, the galactic center lies some 28,000 light years beyond the teapot, because the teapot is made of stars in our neighborhood. And we pass through the galactic center every single year without ill effect. Right, there is a dark rift of gas between us and the center of the galaxy. So if you take a beautiful picture of the Milky Way toward the center, you will see dark rifts of gas, because spiral galaxies like the Milky Way have lots and lots and lots of gas in them, and you can actually see that.
All right. Well, Dustin, rest easy. Thank you for that call. The next one is Dick in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hi, Dick. Thanks for joining us on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning.
Go ahead, Dick.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So basically, if the spacecraft that was traveling to Mars had a rotation, would it be able to simulate gravity to eliminate the issues of zero gravity problems?
Yeah. Could it simulate gravity on board? What do you think, Mal? It's a great question, Dick.
Thanks for calling, Dick. That's a wonderful question. And it's one that's been addressed before. I notice in a lot of science fiction movies about space, they've had rotating spacecraft, even as far back as 2001 Space Odyssey comes to mind, where they had the space station rotating to provide some gravity and stuff. I'm not sure that that necessarily is what the plan is, because it would be perhaps a little more costly to create a spacecraft to do that. But that's an interesting idea. One of the things about Mars, if you go there, you will, of course, have gravity on the surface of Mars, but it's not as it's about just slightly over a third of what the gravity of Earth would be when you get there. So there has been some talk. I've seen write-ups about designing a spacecraft that might have a rotating section to it that would at least simulate that type of gravity. Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe we should talk to NASA and push that a little bit more.
Well, and NASA really wants to go to Mars. I mean,
absolutely.
you go to their website, you visit the Kennedy Space Center down in Florida, and it's just everywhere. They really want to do it. Is it money that's holding them back? Is it technological challenges like the one that our caller raises? What do you think, Mal?
Well, think about what we did when we went to the moon. We got there in 10 years,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, it was fast.
Or a little less than that, actually. And we got them from 1961 was our first flight with Alan Shepard in May. And then in July of, previous to that, we got to the moon and orbited it in 1968. But then we landed finally in July of 69. But we had to take these little baby steps. We had to learn. We were so new at space at the time, we didn't even know if people could swallow food while they were in space in that environment. We thought we always needed gravity to do that. So we've learned that, okay, things are okay. But to go to Mars is such so many times more dangerous, if you will. Mars, for example, does not have a magnetic field around it like the Earth does. So you're always going to be exposed to cosmic rays from the sun, which we're not. We don't have to worry about here on the Earth. You have to know how to protect people. We have to learn so many things before we get there. That's why it's going to take so long.
Yeah, and as I understand, they are looking at the effects of radiation right now on the human body to see what would happen to people during that long flight, never mind once they got there.
Exactly. But just to get to Mars is going to take you about 7 months average or so, one way.
All right, well, Mars seems like a short trip, John, to some of the planets that you've been following. I'm talking about the extrasolar planets. These are the planets discovered in other solar systems far, far from our own. This is called the extrasolar planetary count. And more people are discovering every day almost, it seems like, there are these other planets orbiting other stars. What's the count up to now, John?
Well, as of this morning at 6 o'clock, I wanted to make sure that Mal couldn't scoop me. was 853 confirmed extrasolar planets orbiting stars other than the sun.
I only had 820.
And it's updated every day. Whenever there's a new discovery, there's a beautiful website called the Extrasolar Planet Encyclopedia that's maintained by Jean Schneider in the Paris Observatory. And that as soon as there's a new discovery, it's posted almost immediately. So that means there are 853 confirmed planets orbiting other stars. And in some of those systems, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 planets that have been discovered in various systems.
And maybe we should use the verb, John, detected instead of discovered, right? Because they're detected by looking at the wobble of the star. Discovered to me feels like, you know, people actually saw it on their telescopes or something.
Well, it's interesting you make that.
You can't see these things, can you?
Well, about 32 planets have been imaged directly at this point in time. The first one was directly imaged in 2008, and now there have been a bunch that have been directly imaged. The problem with doing that is that stars are about a billion times brighter than planets are in the visible light part of the electromagnetic energy spectrum. So they're hard to see. It's like trying to read the wattage of a bulb with the bulb turned on. It's just the star is just too bright. But we found ways to obscure the light of the star so that the planets, which are dimmer, much, much dimmer, can be seen. And now a number of them have been imaged directly.
Wow. So not just looking at, you know, the wobble and doing a mathematical equation that tells us it's there, but been imaged directly.
Yes.
And have we found that Goldilocks planet, you know, not too hot, not too cold, just right?
Yeah, we've actually found several planets in the Goldilocks or the habitable zone about their parent star. Probably should mention that a lot of these extrasolar planets have been discovered in stars that are 20, 40, 100, 5,000 light years away, which is pretty far. But recently, just a couple of months ago, Swiss scientists, the same team of astronomers that detected in 1995 the first planet orbiting a sun-like star, discovered that there was a planet orbiting a star in the Alpha Centauri star system. Now, that's a it's a star that you can't see from the northern hemisphere. You can see it from like Tijuana or the Florida Keys and points further south than that. But this is a triple star system, and a planet has been found to be orbiting one of the stars in that system, only 4 1/3 light years away.
Sounds awfully far still, John, but I hear what you're saying. And Mal, real quick, there's a nice meteor show going on this week on Thursday, the Geminid meteor showers.
Yes, the Geminids overnight, Thursday night into Friday morning is the peak. It's going to be great because there's a new moon, which means no moon to interfere with your view. Bundle up. It's going to be cold, but well worth going out in the early morning hours of Friday morning if you can get up around 3 o'clock or so. And just scan the sky for a few minutes, as long as you can stand it. Possibly as many as one a minute.
Wow, great.
The Geminids are a good shower because it's a kind of a shower you can actually start looking early in the evening, like 9 or 10. And you can stay out all night if you want.
For those of us who don't want to get up at midnight. Guys, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it. It was good to see you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Laura.
Our sky guys are Mal Cameron and John Gianforte. This is The Exchange on NHPR.